I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right, joining me now, he was the Republican nominee for Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania. He is a strategist. He has Donald Trump's ear, and he's a great personal friend of mine as well. He's Jeff Bartos. Follow him on X at Jeff_Bartos. What's up, my man?
Rich, great to see you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you had an op-ed in the New York Post today. Very, very cool. Congratulations on that. Is that your first op-ed in the New York Post?
It is my first op-ed in the New York Post. They were great to work with. They liked the idea. We worked through the idea and the timing of it. I mean, when I started to write it, I didn't realize that General Kelly would conspire with a couple other folks and spread some horrific lie about the former president, the greatest friend that Israel's ever had in the White House and a champion in combating anti-Semitism. So the timing, I think, couldn't have been better. But I sincerely wish that we were not talking about the things that we've seen over the last 24 hours. It's really unconscionable what the desperation of the vice president and her team at this point.
Yeah, and I thought it was absolutely pathetic for the vice president of the United States, behind the seal of the vice president, to come out and compare her running mate to Adolf Hitler. I thought that was just based on rumor, you know, as this the rumor that John Kelly's spreading, which has been, by the way, several people have said that's not true. It's not even been corroborated by anybody. But for her to come out there and echo that is just really, really beneath the office, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's dangerous. It's irresponsible.
Dangerous, yep.
It's unconscionable. It is the desperate act of a campaign that in 100 days it was born in desperation. It's lived in desperation, and it's going to extinguish itself on November 5th. Probably, I would guess, by 11 p.m., maybe 1 a.m. on November 6th. It's going to extinguish itself and never have found a message in 100 days. It's really, we've not seen anything like it in our times. And you know, we expect better. And she's really let herself down. And I think she'll look back on this and say, you know, this was just not the way to campaign. It wasn't the way to end a failing campaign.
Yeah, it was not. And also, too, it's dangerous. We talked about that, you and I, on text. But in the wake of two assassination attempts, to compare your opponent to Hitler, when history looks back on the people that tried to kill Hitler as heroes, and rightly so, and the people that tried to lead coups against him and take him out, it sends a message to people that you've got to stop this evil to save democracy. And an unhinged person hears that and thinks that this is the right thing to do, the morally correct thing to do. And that's why that kind of rhetoric is especially dangerous. You know, I mean, political rhetoric, they keep saying both sides have to tone it down. I'm sorry, but no one on our side is comparing Kamala Harris to a genocidal maniac.
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways to look at this. I've thought for a while that every utterance from the vice president and her proxies, whether it's Governor Walz or others, is either a confession or a projection. I don't think that the vice president or Governor Walz are proto-fascists or anti-Semites. I don't get that sense. So I'm not. This isn't a confession or a projection. This is just pure evil. What they're doing. And I would not be working for Donald Trump for the last year proudly, working to help with the Jewish vote and to spread messages about his support for the U.S.-Israel relationship. His incredible record of combating anti-Semitism if I didn't believe wholeheartedly, but I know him. I respect mm-hmm. him. I enjoy spending time with him. He's a wonderful person in addition to a great leader. And so, I mean, Rich, let's just take it point by point. President Trump issued an executive order in 2019 that is allowing today. It is the only reason today that students like Shabbos Kestenbaum and others can sue Harvard, Penn, MIT, Columbia. Those lawsuits are enabled 100%. Not 95%, 100% by the executive order that President Trump issued in 2019, permitting anti-Semitism to be a category that students can sue under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, period. There's no disputing that. President Trump's appointed two terrific people, my friends Ilan Karr and Eli Kohanim, to the positions of special envoy and deputy special envoy combating anti-Semitism on a global basis out of the State Department. They did incredible work and are both continuing to do that work now in other jobs after the administration ended. And then we could go, I mean, Rich, you and I could talk for an hour about President Trump and his team's support for the U.S.-Israel relationship and what they built with the Abraham Accords, which just continue to pay dividends for Israel, for the Gulf Arab states, and for global commerce in the United States, our national security. So it's his record is the best in modern history, if not our entire history, maybe all the way back to George Washington. So when the vice president says that it's dangerous, it's corrupt, it's unconscionable, and it's really beneath her. It's beneath the office. And again, I think she'll reflect. I've lost a couple of campaigns, Rich. I know something, one or two things about losing a campaign. You reflect on what you did right and what you could have done better. She's going to look back on this and feel, I think, really a tremendous amount of regret that she walked down this path that she never should have gone down.
And I think she's also going to feel regret that she didn't pick Josh Shapiro as a running mate. I don't think she would have won, but I think it would have been her odds would have been better. And she clearly didn't pick him because he's Jewish. And when the mayor of that city in Michigan came out, who's Muslim with 60% Muslim population and endorsed Donald Trump, I just thought, man, you know, there's got to be people in Josh Shapiro's orbit who are celebrating the fact that he's probably going to be running in 4 years now because she's going to lose. And a big part of the reason why was she was afraid that by picking a Jewish person on her ticket, she would upset a lot of these Muslims in places like Michigan, because that's what they do. They stereotype people.
Yeah, they have to divide. Their only stock in trade and their only power is to divide people and turn them against each other. It's classic Marxism, right? I mean, it's what they learned. It's what they learned in their small seminars at Columbia or Harvard or Berkeley or wherever some of these geniuses that work for the vice president went. No, I think you're absolutely, you taught me this line and I use it now all the time. She's walking down the middle. She's trying to walk a fine line down the middle and she's getting hit by both sides. You got to pick a lane and you got to stick to it and you got to understand why you're doing it. I use your line all the time. It's a great line because it happens to be, as Henry Kissinger used to say, it has the virtue of being true.
Well, I wish I could say it was my line. I heard it. I don't remember who told me that line, but thank you. If you want to give me credit for it, Jeff Bartos, by all means, I'll take it. No question about it. Especially since now you are a published op-ed writer in the New York Post. It's a pretty big freaking deal. Let's talk about your op-ed, though, because you wrote this and you said, look, Republicans battled anti-Semitism on college campuses. Donald Trump battled anti-Semitism on college campuses. Let's expand the Republican majority here going forward. And I think you did an excellent job of contrasting that with the wacko college presidents, like right here in at Penn, for example. And while I'm a free speech absolutist, these people are not, and they have censored people for their speech, and they have gone after people for speech they didn't like. So if you're going to do that, then you are subject to criticism for the speech that you do allow. If you don't have just a blanket policy of freedom of speech, if you pick and choose, well, then the speech that you allow, you're going to get credit for that. So, or in this case, I should say, negative credit for that.
Yeah, I think it's a really important, that's why I wrote about it. The central thesis of the op-ed, and I really appreciate you reaching out and highlighting it. The central thesis is anybody who watched Elise Stefanik and Virginia Fox, and some of the other great members of the House Workforce Education and Workforce Committee in December, take apart those three college presidents by asking them a simple question. Is calling for the genocide of Jews violation of your code of conduct? And those three presidents, with total moral ambiguity and a lack of moral clarity, couldn't answer the question. And my point to everyone I speak to now is, if you are glad that you got to see that moral ambiguity and that moral rot in higher education, if you feel like that was a worthwhile effort, then you have to thank the Republican majority in the House, because but for Republican chairs having those gavels and holding those hearings, the world would not have witnessed or borne witness to that moral rot. And you can't start to fix things until you know there's a problem. And we have to thank the very narrow majority in the United States House of Representatives and leaders like Mike Johnson and Virginia Fox and Elise Stefanik and Jim Jordan and Jason Smith and all of their colleagues who are participating in these hearings. And then, okay, I live in Lower Marion, as you know. I live in the land of highly educated, maybe less common sense folks. And they'll say to me, well, how do you know that the Democrats wouldn't do that? And I'll say, well, look at the United States Senate. The Democrats hold the gavels and the majority in the United States Senate. Rich, in the last year, 10 hearings in the House, zero hearings in the Senate focused exclusively on anti-Semitism. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which passed with broad bipartisan support in the House, can't even get to a floor vote. We have a senior senator in Bob Casey not using any of his seniority or authority in the Senate to push that bill, even though he's a co-sponsor. Senator Schumer will not call it for a vote. And so it's just DOA sitting in the Senate, not moving. If people care about exposing and then repairing the moral rot in our society that is stemming from anti-Semitism and this sort of age-old hatred, then elect a broader majority in the United States House on November 5th and elect a Republican majority in the United States Senate. And of course, return President Trump and his team to the White House, as we talked about their record. And I make a key point of talking about Pennsylvania in the op-ed, which is we have three races in Pennsylvania where Republican challengers are looking good to flip Democrat held seats right now. That's you have PA7, you have PA8, and you have PA17 out in the western part of the state. You have Rob Mercury in the west, and you have Rob Bresnahan and Ryan McKenzie here in the Northeast and the Lehigh Valley. And then, of course, we have Dave McCormick looking great right now as likely to unseat our three-term 18-year incumbent, Bob Casey.
And Jeff, having run statewide in Pennsylvania, what worries you going into the final 12 days of this, if anything?
No, you always worry about get out the vote. You always worry about it. I mean, Rich, I'm a little, I like to worry. My family will tell you. So I worried on election day, is there going to be a storm? Is there going to be a power outage? Yeah. Is there going to be a once in a generation cyclone, a tornado? I remember my primary election in 2018, there was a band of thunderstorms that rolled through right around the last 2 hours of the polls being open. I thought, oh, good. No one's going to vote and I'm going to lose. Right. So you always worry. You always worry. So I think for Republicans, for independents, and for Democrats who embrace common sense, get out there and vote now. You can still vote by mail. I mean, the deadline to register has been passed now, but you can still ask for a mail-in ballot. You can still vote by mail. Bank your vote. Get your vote in. The Republican Party doesn't have to chase you anymore. We know your vote's in. But if you're going to vote on Election Day, have a plan to vote. Make sure what you're going to do. Make sure when you're going to get there. Make sure you're ready to wait in line if you need to, and just make sure your vote is counted. I think that's at this point, it's getting out the vote. We're going to see over the next 11 or 12 days, crisscrossing the state, all the candidates. But at this point, it's turnout, enthusiasm. I feel great about where we are. I'm highly confident that President Trump's going to carry the state. I'm highly confident that Dave McCormick is going to unseat our 18-year incumbent with no record to show.
And by the way, what do you make of the fact that Casey is running towards Donald Trump and not even mentioning that he's a Democrat in any of his campaign ads? That's very telling.
Let's go back to where we started the conversation. The vice president stood on the steps of the vice president's residence in Washington, D.C., in front of the seal of the vice president, and called Donald Trump names I'm not even going to repeat, referred to him as some of the worst people in history, and recalled him a fascist again last night in Delco during the town hall. Bob Casey didn't get that memo from the vice president because he's hugging President Trump. He's hugging President Trump's policies, and he's letting voters know that I stand with President Trump, which I don't think that they're clearly not talking, but one of those is obviously off. The Democrats, as I said before, they don't have a message. They are in desperation mode. It's every man or woman for themselves. Bob Casey's chosen to hug President Trump because President Trump's going to win Pennsylvania. The vice president's chosen to go down a very dark path that she'll never recover from. Her career will be done after this because she went down this road, and she's going to deeply regret what she's done. But it's crazy what Bob Casey's done. When I asked my Democrat friends in Lower Merion, what do you think about that, Rich? You know what they do? They look down. They literally look at the ground. They look at their shoes. They have no answer to why Bob Casey is embracing President Trump.
Well, I think we've got our answer, my friend. And last thing I'll say is that Jaime's is a great restaurant, and they have the best matzah, and also their pickle bar is outstanding as well.
Yes, I went there for some comfort food 10 days ago and got pastrami and corned beef hot on rye with Russian dressing and coleslaw. I'm usually more of a salad guy, as you know.
Right.
And our friend Lewis, it's funny the way the world works. What the press has not reported is that commercial was filmed on a Monday, and 6 days later, Dana Bash and a whole bunch of Democrats for Kamala were holding a conclave with CNN cameras filming in the same restaurant. So within a 6 day period, Jaime's hosted an ad for the Republican Jewish Coalition, not even one of the candidates, the Republican Jewish Coalition Action Fund filmed an ad there. Mm-hmm. And then within 6 days, the Kamala Harris campaign, along with Democrats on the main line, along with CNN, were in there filming. Lewis supports the community. Jaime's is always there to support local charities. And it's a wonderful restaurant with wonderful employees and a great owner and a completely nonpartisan. Within a 6-day period, you had both presidential campaigns in there. The fact that the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Magazine and others are writing articles about this, they just don't like business owners who actually turn a profit, Rich. They'd rather have people losing money.
Well said. Follow Jeff on X at Jeff_Bartos. We'll post a link to his excellent op-ed in the New York Post. Thanks, my friend. I look forward to talking to you again very, very soon and hopefully celebrating a big win on election night together.
Thank you so much for having me. Always great to see you.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right, as we continue along here in our fourth and final hour, almost to Friday, almost to the end of this election. Can you believe it? 1 week from today is Halloween. That's crazy. That is crazy. And that's the big story of the hour, brought to you by our buddy, Dr. Mike Veneria, VeneriaDental.com. Mark down Saturday, November 9th for his Veterans Breakfast and free community shredding event, VeneriaDental.com. I was thinking about, well, there's a story about how dementia risk rises with any amount of alcohol, according to a new study. And I know this is the time of the show where I typically talk about alcohol and also food because I'm starving and you may be even enjoying your dinner right now. Or maybe you're stuck in traffic. I don't know. I left the studio last night a little bit after 7 o'clock. It was bumper to bumper everywhere. It was brutal. So I hope I can make your drive home a little bit better. That's the goal here. But if you're looking to get home and pop open bottle of wine or make yourself a little old-fashioned. According to science, there's no level of alcohol consumption that does not increase the risk of dementia among drinkers. Using statistical methods based on genetic analysis, the authors of the study found that alcohol heightened dementia risk in proportion to the amount of alcohol consumed. The study contradicts earlier research that suggested light to moderate drinking may protect against dementia. I have a feeling that at the end of the day, what this is all going to come down to is probably something that our grandparents were very good at telling us. Moderation. Moderation in everything in life seems to be key. You know what I mean? Moderation. It seems to be good for you. But I don't know. I was making pizza dough all day. Not all day, but you know, a lot of the day today. And as I was doing that, I kept thinking to myself, this will be much better with a nice glass of our homemade wine to go with the homemade pizza dough. But obviously, I couldn't do that and then do the show. So that's how it is. But I don't know. I mean, the good news is that if you drink a lot, you're going to forget about this study very, very soon. So that's the good news right there. Who gets TikTok in the divorce? The messy fight over valuable social media accounts. When couples who want to make their living online split up, assessing the account's future value and divvying up the accounts fairly is a drag. The Wall Street Journal has this story. This is why I always tell you, lawyers always win. When Kat and Mike Stickler filed for divorce, their lawyers had a math problem. Among the couple's biggest assets was Mike and Kat, a channel on TikTok and YouTube in which they shared their lives with about 4 million followers. No one knew how to evenly split Mike and Kat between Mike and Kat. The judge was like, what? It's a whole new terrain. Social media pays the bills for millions of Americans, but making a living online is much more financially complicated than working a 9-to-5 job. Influencers need an audience to win advertising deals, and changing what they post risks turning followers away. Couples who showcase their love life online face an existential threat to the family business when they split. For the lawyers charged with pinning a dollar value to the accounts to divide them fairly, it's way harder than assessing a house or car. Fortunes can swing depending on which ex has the keys to the account. That was Kat's argument in fighting for control of the TikTok channel. She said, if the TikTok account was left to me, it would keep growing, but if it wasn't, it would stop. She was right. She got the TikTok, changed that handle to Kat Stickler, and now has almost 10.5 million followers. She has another 3 million across Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. The channels where she posts skits impersonating her mother and snippets of her everyday life have earned her enough to buy a condo and become a small business investor. What are we doing wrong is my question. Mike ended up with a YouTube account, which is now defunct. He now worked in sales and declined to comment. There are 27 million paid content creators in the U.S., and 44% of them say social media is their full-time job. Wow. The big bucks don't come from views or follows. Brands pay influencers to recommend a product or service to their audience. U.S. advertisers paid content creators $26 billion in 2023. Once divorce specialists tally up how much money the accounts are raking in, the couple can divide them, or one partner can take more and buy out the other. But there's one elusive factor in a digital asset's value: the account's potential to keep making money. Both partners have to make a case for their role in that potential. How many pranks did they think of? How many hours did they spend editing videos? There's typically one person in the relationship who's passionate about social media, who's driving the business. There's a talent management group, and they represent some of TikTok's most followed couples and influencers. It's not always clear who the person is by the time the divorce rolls around. Social media success often evolves quickly, and couples may not be prepared to track finances and labor. This one couple say everything they've done to amass about 5 million followers on shared channels has been a team effort. They started posting about their wedding in 2020, and within months, the woman was able to quit her office job. Now they estimate social media brings in about $500,000 a year. What are we doing wrong here? Almost all that goes into a joint bank account. It was a little overwhelming to see their incomes jump so fast, far above what their parents made. Now, I guess truly this is the future of everything. As I open up TikTok and see how many followers I have. Let's see here now. I've got 2,000 followers just about on TikTok. That's probably not enough. And I got another community content violation. Why did I get a community content violation? What is that about? The entire thing was just, I said, whoever wins Pennsylvania wins the election, but Democrats bled more votes in this in any other county. And for that, I got flagged on TikTok. My video was removed. They remove a lot of stuff over there. How do I disagree with that decision is my question. I don't know. It's apparently now it was removed for false election information. Do you know that if you post anything that even suggests election impropriety or anything, do you know that they will take it down? They will strike that down immediately. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous. No other TikTok seems to be the worst with this stuff. I guess because they're trying to not get banned. And it's really annoying, too, because I've been a defender of TikTok not getting banned. And I've been defending them, and they still take down my videos. And all the entire video is just simply about the fact that in one particular county in Philadelphia, Democrat voters have been flipping Republican. And it's right here in Philadelphia County. Democrats have lost more versus Republican gains. I'm not saying they flipped the county, but Democrats are hemorrhaging voters. So for that, I got a content violation on TikTok. This is why they hate Elon Musk. You know, Elon Musk doesn't pull this crap. At least I don't think he does. Every now and then, somebody will say something got taken down or something. But for the most part, he has turned X into a free speech platform. And for that reason, they hate him. And that's why they keep going after him with all the various investigations into his companies and trying to get him for millions and millions of dollars. They're trying to get him. They want him to pay. They want him to pay. That's what it really comes down to. And stuff like this. Like, you know, there's this doctor who refused to publish a trans kids study that showed puberty blockers didn't help mental health. You know, if you post stuff like that, sometimes social media will take it down because they call it hate speech. This is what I mean about it. If Democrats get their way, they'll label things hate speech and you won't be able to discuss them on social media. A prominent doctor and trans rights advocate admitted she deliberately withheld publication of a $10 million taxpayer-funded study on the effect of puberty blockers on American children after finding no evidence that they improve patients' mental health. Dr. Joanna Olson Kennedy told the New York Times that she believes the study would be weaponized by critics of transgender care for kids and that the research could one day be used in court to argue we shouldn't use blockers. Critics, including one of her fellow researchers on the study, said the decision flies in the face of research standards and deprives the public of really important science in a field where Americans remain firmly divided. For the National Institutes of Health-funded study, researchers chose 95 kids who had an average age of 11 and gave them puberty-blocking drugs starting in 2015. The treatments are meant to delay the onset of bodily changes like the development of breasts or the deepening of the voice. Is Brian Stelter on those? Well, he probably, I mean, he has man boobs, so, but it's the deepening of the voice that I want. Anyway, 11 years old. They're giving this stuff to 11-year-old kids. It's just child abuse is what it is. It's barbaric child abuse. After following up with the Utes for 2 years, the treatments did not improve the state of their mental health, which Olson Kennedy chalked up to the kids being in really good shape, both when they started and concluded the two-year treatment. However, the Times points out that her rosy assessment contradicts earlier data recorded by the researchers, which found around one quarter of study participants were depressed or suicidal before receiving treatment. It does also not support the findings of a 2011 Dutch study, which is the primary scientific research cited by proponents of giving kids puberty blockers. The study of 70 kids found that children treated with puberty blockers reported better mental health and fewer behavior and emotional problems. Olson Kennedy, the outlet points out, is one of the country's leading advocates for providing gender-affirming care to adolescents. Translation, giving kids to 11-year-olds, drugs to 11-year-olds. Can you imagine if an 11-year-old wanted to do cocaine, drink a beer, drive a car, smoke cigarettes? We would never allow this. But we'll give an 11-year-old puberty-blocking drugs. And if these whack jobs had their way, we'd chop off his 11-year-old schwanz. They would. I mean, that's what these people would do. They're that sick. They're that barbaric. Now, these results have not been made public after 9 years. The doctor said, I do not want our work to be weaponized. It has to be exactly on point, clear and concise, and that takes time. Now, you know what it is? It's just that if the results don't back up what the left wants, they'll just bury the results. That's why you can't believe these people when they tell you what science has declared, because they manipulate science and data all the time. A Washington Post KFF Trans in America survey found that 68% of U.S. adults are against providing puberty blockers to trans-identifying youth ages 10 to 14. 58% oppose hormone treatments for those ages 15 to 17. Boston College clinical research psychologist Amy Tishelman, who was one of the original researchers on the study, pointed out the obvious contradiction in withholding scientific evidence on the grounds that it doesn't match an expected conclusion. I understand the fear about it being weaponized, she said, but it's really important to get the science out there. No change isn't necessarily a negative finding. There could be a preventative aspect to it. We just don't know without more investigation. I'll tell you what this is. What this is that if they feel like it could hurt their funding, they won't release the data. They won't release the data. That's what it comes down to. Puberty blockers don't help mental health, and that flies in the face of what the left wants people to believe. They use a lie. They say, better to have a live boy than a dead girl. They say those things. And that's just not, it's not matched by science. But they argue, though, your kid's going to kill herself or himself if you don't allow them to go down this road. And that's, again, it's not bad. Science does not back that up. But when you hear people on the left go out there and talk about science all the time, just remember that these people, they wind up manipulating science for their benefit. We saw this with COVID, and we see it with this stuff, too. All right, we got a lot more to get into, including Kamala Harris's disastrous town hall meeting last night. Amazon blaming AI-generated responses for its pro-Kamala biases. It's our fourth and final hour. Remember, hold November 13th. Mark the date on your calendar. I'll tell you why. Hopefully next week we'll be able to tell you exactly why. But for now, you just be wise to hold the date. We're coming right back.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
So remember after the debate, everybody said Kamala won the debate. I told you Kamala did not win the debate. Frank Luntz came out and predicted that she was going to win the election after that. You remember that? Frank Luntz, with his bad toupee, came out and said Kamala was going to win. That was his big prediction. What is Frank Luntz saying now is the question. What is Frank Luntz saying now on our fourth and final hour on Talk Radio 1210 WPHD? Let's take a listen.
I think that clip illustrates exactly why Harris is in trouble at this point. And it's something that I don't understand why the campaign does not address. They asked her specifically, where do you stand on the wall? And what does she do? She goes and shifts it right to Donald Trump. Immediately mentions him twice. Right. Within the first 5 seconds, she still hasn't closed the deal. She still hasn't said to people exactly what she would do. In fact, what she should have done in the opening of that town hall is said, I want to tell you what I'm going to do in the first hour, in the first day, and in the first week. And it's going to take me 5 minutes. So, Anderson, you're going to have to sit tight. Here's what we're going to do by 1 p.m. She didn't do any of that. She hasn't told the public step by step what she's about.
And that's because nobody knows what she's about. She doesn't know what she's about. There's nothing transparent about this candidacy. She has no stance on anything. Nothing. She's an empty shell. But she's a super progressive. So just remember that. She's a big, gigantic progressive. Do not forget that. But every answer she gives is about Trump. Every answer she gives is Trump bad, Trump bad, Trump bad, Trump bad. And it's not helping her. Hell, even Bill Clinton says she's vulnerable. Even Bill Clinton says Kamala is extremely vulnerable.
But about 45% of the people think he can do no wrong, and they don't care if we save our democracy or not. So there is a sliver there that has to make up their mind. And to them, Kamala Harris just showed up. I mean, she was there as vice president, and what they think of her largely depends on what they think of President Biden. But she is extremely vulnerable, more vulnerable than she deserves to be, through crazy attacks. So they've been thinking, the Republicans, all this time, how can we go on the attack?
No, how about Slick Willie? By the way, he hit on Kari Lake in Arizona. I don't know. Did you catch that?
Running against someone who is physically attractive but believes that politics is a performance art. Running against someone
who just can't help but be a friggin' creep. You know what I mean? Like, the guy just cannot help but be a creep, Bill Clinton. Everywhere he goes, he just creeps people out. Even at funerals. Ethel Kennedy's funeral, he creeped people out. Like, can you just go one place and not freak people out? Is that asking too much of Bill Clinton? President Trump is now viewed more favorably than Kamala Harris.
At this next thing here in terms of favorability, Harris has lost all her post-convention bounce. She went from +3 in the September NBC poll to -10 back where she was in our August survey. That's a sign Trump has been landing blows on her image, and maybe perhaps she's been doing it to herself as well. Trump maintains his -13 to -6. He was -13 in August too, so he's improved his favorability. Looking at this next thing here in terms of favorability.
He's improved his favorability. Remember, favorability was the big thing? Favorability was the big thing, and that's what it was. And that's the issue here. And you know what it really comes down to? I mean, what it really comes down to is the fact that people realize all of the lies, all the attacks on Trump, none of it is winning over undecided voters. Because what they're talking about is jobs, American manufacturing, and that's what the American workers are worried about. They're not worried about Trump being Hitler. They're worried about losing their jobs, particularly in the oil industry, the energy industry, and the auto industry. Here's Howard Lutnick talking about what's happening with the American workers.
I have a statistic for you. The 2/3 of the American workforce, all right, have a high school education. One-third has a college education. The average life expectancy of the high school education, 7 years less. 7 years less. It's not the air they breathe. It's not the food. It's not the Medicare. Deaton won a Nobel Prize for it, so this isn't a stat you have to worry about. It's a Nobel Prize, right? Despair. If you take the factory away, right, NAFTA, you take the American auto worker and move it to Mexico and you put them out of work. You bring in the Korean cars and you put them out of work. You gut American workers. Where do they go next? And then you open the border and you bring in fentanyl and you're actually gutting the American workforce, and that's why it's going to change. We can build an America. We can build an America, but we have to have tariffs to protect the workers and we have to bring it home.
You know, that's the thing, too. If you think about the opioid epidemic in America, a lot of that was in rural areas where they had lost jobs. Communities had been devastated. I mean, and then they were ripe targets for this. They were ripe targets for this. And he also talks about, he defends tariffs, this Howard Lutnick, and as how Trump would use them as a negotiating tactic.
You are correct. If I raise the tariff on just this particular idiosyncratic product,
yes,
right, it will be more expensive. I agree. But what would I do? I wouldn't buy Fiji water. I buy, you know, another brand of water. I mean,
Sunny.
Yes, you are completely correct. If we don't make that particular product, that will go up. Anybody who says it's inflation is completely wrong because the other product hasn't gone up. There's only one way to get inflation. Print more money and give it to all of us. When we all have more money, everything is more expensive.
Howard,
so here was the idea. Here was the idea. Put a tariff out and say to the company, if you come to America and you produce in America, you get a tax credit for your tariff. So come to America, build in America, and I've spoken to lots. This came from discussions with lots of industry groups, and they said, if you give us 2 years, we can manufacture in America. We'll bring our production to America, and if you give us back our tariff money, we're good with that. That's where that policy.
I mean, that it's, you know, this is, it's pretty basic stuff, isn't it? It really is. It's pretty basic stuff if you think about it. But the real issue in the closing arguments of this is going to be whether or not Kamala Harris can win over undecided voters by calling Donald Trump a fascist, whether or not that's going to work for her, versus the American workers in this country thinking that they're going to lose their jobs, that they are going to see their communities devastated. That's what it comes down to. And I'm telling you right now, you know, for you and I and everyone you know, the smart people that you know in your life, they see through those attacks about Trump being a fascist because he already was president. He was president. And when he was president, he wasn't a fascist. And also inflation was not high. So there's that, too. You know what I mean? Not only was he not a fascist, but inflation was low. Here's Howard Lutnick again talking to CNBC.
It's unbelievable that she gets on television, calls him a fascist. He already was the president. We had, before COVID, we had 3% growth, 3% wage growth and GDP growth, inflation below 2%. He wasn't a fascist. He hired the wrong people. We agree. And now he has disgruntled former employees, right? All these people got fired. Who got fired in the Biden administration? You want to have a fun thought? Did we, when we pulled out of Afghanistan, was it really stupid and a mistake? Like, we left $80 billion worth of stuff behind.
Stipulate.
Was it a mistake? It wasn't. If you think about it, if I get you to quickly move out of your house and leave everything behind, when you get to your new house, what's the first thing you have to buy? A whole bunch of new furniture. So if I leave $80 billion worth of equipment behind, what's the first thing the military-industrial complex is going to do? Buy more stuff. So who hates Donald Trump, who hates war? Dick Cheney.
Exactly.
Of course Dick Cheney. What's
exactly.
Dick Cheney's legacy? Let's go take out Iraq, which Donald Trump says is the dumbest thing that's ever happened in recent military exercise. Why? Iraq and Iran, they kill each other for what? Thousands of years? We take out Iraq and we free Iran to try to take on the West.
It's so well said. It wasn't a mistake leaving that. They left that stuff on purpose. They left that stuff behind on purpose so that the military-industrial complex would have to build more of it and then make more money. He's exactly right. He's a brilliant guy. He's a brilliant guy, that Howard Lutnick. Truly is. And yeah, this is what Kamala Harris says about Donald Trump last night when she's talking to Anderson Cooper, the disastrous town hall.
Do you think Donald Trump is a fascist?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I also believe that the people who know him best on this subject should be trusted.
I think he's a fascist. That's her closing argument. That's her closing argument. Not how are you different than Joe Biden, because she can't answer that question. I mean, she literally cannot answer that question. This was it. Oh, this was bad last night. Oh, this was
considering
bad.
You have been in the position of vice president for the past 4 years under the Biden administration. How can we expect you to deviate from the direction of that administration compared to your own? How can we differentiate your policy and your beliefs from that of Biden's?
That's a great question. And thank you. Well, first of all, my administration will not be a continuation of the Biden administration. I bring to this role my own ideas and my own experience. I represent a new generation of leadership on a number of issues and believe that we have to actually take new approaches. For example, what we talked about in terms of housing. My experience that leads to that priority includes what I did to take on the big banks around the foreclosure crisis when I brought billions of dollars to homeowners that were the subject of predatory lending. I know what homeownership means to the American people, not to mention what it meant to my mother, who worked very hard and saved up so that by the time I was a teenager, she was able to buy our first home. I bring to it my experience actually taking care of my mother when she was sick, and it was, as it turned out, dying from cancer. And so I know what it means and have the experience of taking care of an elderly relative, and I have raised children.
Are you running for nurse? Are you running for home caretaker? Or are you running for president of the United States of America? This is unbelievable. All right, that's the show. Enjoy the rest of your night tonight. I appreciate you listening. We're back tomorrow from 3 to 7. Keep the conversation going on X at Rich Zeoli. Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla straight ahead. Thank you.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.